The Narcolepsy Nerd Alert series invites listeners to dive deeper into specific topics relevant to living with narcolepsy. For more on this topic, please check out our corresponding toolkit, available for free on our website to download, print, and share. The link to the toolkit and other Narcolepsy Nerd Alert topics is in the show notes, or you can go to project-sleep.com. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. Thanks for joining us today. So excited to have a really important discussion with some amazing people. So just want to have everyone just quickly introduce themselves. We also have two Katies today. So why don't we just quickly have Dr. Sharkey introduce yourself and then our other Katie.
Sure. So I am Katie Sharkey. I am a sleep medicine physician in Providence, Rhode Island. I work for Brown Physicians, and I have the pleasure of caring for many people who are living with narcolepsy with and without cataplexy. And I'm a huge Project Sleep lover. I just think that what you do, Julie, is so great. And shout out to your alma mater, Brown, like where I am and where you went. So yeah, I'm really thrilled to be here to talk about this symptom and how it impacts people.
Thank you, Dr. Sharkey. And I forgot to mention, yes, we're talking about coping with cataplexy today. all right, our other Katie.
Good afternoon, Katie Meehan. I'm coming to you from Phoenix, Arizona. I am a graduate of the Rising Voices of Narcolepsy Advocacy Program, and I have narcolepsy with cataplexy. I was diagnosed just before my sophomore year of college after having had 5 years of symptoms with no diagnosis. And so I am excited to be here today to share about what that has looked like for me, and also to give a perspective from a working mom who has two small children and can talk through what pregnancy with cataplexy was like, nursing, all the things that come that you might have questions about that I can give from my personal recommendations inside.
All right. So coping with cataplexy, how the heck do you do it? What is cataplexy? If you're not as familiar with this, you know, how we describe it is striking sudden muscle weakness or paralysis triggered by strong emotions. And really, that's the, you know, we're going with a sort of like the boring clinical thing that's not really all that clear what that really means, but that's how it's generally defined. The severity and duration can vary. So it can be just a small form of weakness in your head, your knees, your arms, or it could be, you know, more full body, completely falling to the ground and not being able to move. I think it's really important, and we try to train our Rising Voices advocates to always point out that a person does remain conscious generally throughout the cataplexy experience. And this really helps to distinguish cataplexy from a lot of other things that kind of might look similar, like fainting or most seizures, I believe. And Dr. Sharkey, chime in if that's incorrect, but I believe that's, you know, conscious staying while you're paralyzed or you're, you know, having this weakness, but you know it's happening is somewhat of a distinguishing factor. Is that correct?
Yes. And although I think that somebody who's observing cataplexy might not be able to tell that the person is awake and aware, right? So one of the things that that brings to mind for me is people who've gotten medical, you know, who have episode of cataplexy and someone rushes to their aid and the person who thinks they're helping does not realize the person can hear them. And, you know, that can be distressing. So I think, you know, if there are, you know, people who might respond or health practitioners listening, I think remembering the person's awake and can hear you. And it can be really, people sometimes don't say things that they would say if they were realizing people were awake. I also can think of an example of somebody who, like, their partner sometimes thinks that they're asleep, but really they feel like they're awake, and they're like, no, I was awake the whole time. So yeah, that it's the perception, I think, is different if you're having it versus observing it.
Right. Because it can be that full body. So your eyelids are muscle and they can close, right? So it might look quite calm and peaceful. I don't think entirely. For me, it's usually a little bit more jerky, fighting the cataplexy up and down and like, you know, bobbing my head more than a complete. But if it is complete, it might look like the person's asleep or passed out. I like to point it out because I also think when people think of narcolepsy as somewhat of a joke or not a really serious thing, to explain to someone that you're conscious, that you're awake in a body that's not moving and not able to command the way that you want to, like move a finger, move a toe, and like nothing's moving, is, I think, a really scary and startling experience. I wouldn't wish upon anyone, really. So yeah, just to point out, about 70%, we believe, I don't know, we see different statistics now about type 1 versus type 2. And so cataplexy is a distinguishing factor of type 1 narcolepsy, as opposed to type 2, where generally there is no cataplexy. I think that's pretty accurate for the most part. So let's see. All right. So what does cataplexy look like? And I know we have Katie Meehan with a lot of personal experience too. I remember, Katie, one of your stories from Rising Voices. So many, but in your dormitory, and some of how cataplexy first showed. So do you want to share about how you first saw some of the symptoms?
Yeah. So I started showing symptoms in high school. And at the time, my doctor was my pediatrician, and she just equated it to being clumsy as a teenager and it like being tired as just also being a typical teenage thing. And so when I got to college, I was used to falling. My muscle tone weakness was typically in my knees. So I would just kind of lose muscle tone and kind of drop to the ground. I've never had a full episode where it's my whole body, but I would drop to the ground. So like if I'm walking out my dorm room door and someone is on the other side and I didn't expect them there, it is likely I would drop to the ground. And so in those experiences, all these new people were seeing me fall all the time and not understanding why I was falling. So I was having...
Katie, when you were falling, was it like you were dropping down to your knees sort of?
I had kind of trained myself to drop into like a crisscross applesauce position. So it was like, I would feel the muscle weakness in my knees and then just kind of know like, okay, I need to like separate my legs so that when I fall, I'm going to fall safely versus like just topple over.
That is so innovative for having had to deal with it, I guess, for so long, unmedicated and without knowing what it was.
Yeah. But I think that's I've had many people tell me that, right? That they can tell that it's going to happen, like that they can make themselves safe before they don't, you know, can anticipate it so they don't get hurt.
Yeah. And so in college, all these new people were seeing this happening. And then finally my hall director approached me and she was like, have you been drinking? Is there something I should be concerned about? And I was like, no, like, this is very normal for me. I get that it's probably not most people's normal, but I've been dealing with this for a long time. And so she was the one that essentially told me like, no, you really need to go get this checked out further. And so when I did finally go and see a neurologist that day, they had mentioned to me like, do you ever have phone conversations where you lose muscle tone? Do you ever fall when you're by yourself? Things like that. And at the time I was thinking, no, like I don't have experiences like that. And so in that meeting, the neurologist said it could be that it was behavioral and that I was just trying to fall and do these things to get attention.
Because it was only happening when you were like around other people.
And so that really shocked me and frustrated me, but I wasn't sure what else to ask about that at the time. So we went forward with planning to do different tests to rule out different things. But at the very end of that appointment, they had mentioned cataplexy. However, they didn't tell me what cataplexy was. And so when I got back to where I could actually go and Google cataplexy and read the definition, I was like, oh, like this makes sense. And then that same day I had an experience where I was standing in a circle of a group of friends and someone came up behind me and just like lightly, jokingly tapped me on the head with a soda bottle and I dropped to the ground. And I was like, okay, I think we are onto something here. This makes more sense. And then I went down the rabbit hole of looking up more about narcolepsy and cataplexy and really felt like, okay, this is something I need to investigate further.
Yeah. It's just so helpful to like think about all the different example stories, I think, to really make it real beyond that initial definition. So I know, you know, looking at this list here really quickly about what does it look like? Slurred speech is a big one for me when it's subtle. And so that can, like you mentioned clumsiness, but also drunkenness, right? So, you know, I had a boyfriend where I remember one day I was reading a greeting card to him and it was a really funny greeting card. So he didn't even have to see me. He was like in the other room and he could tell I was having cataplexy trying to read the greeting card to him because of my speech. I didn't even really quite recognize it. Also, I just wanted to tell him the funny thing from the card. So I didn't want to like, but he was like, maybe you want to sit down, like tell me in a second. And I was like, no. So I think, you know, slurred speech. And for me, definitely a lot of head bobbing or, you know, even just that jaw slackening or feeling like you have cotton in your mouth and you can't quite say things. Of course, that knee buckling that like Katie described, that's how mine started, was knee buckling at first and then holding a glass at a party or a mug and then trying to like someone saying something funny and almost losing my grip on the mug, not entirely. And people couldn't really even notice at first. I was like something just felt weird to me. But I think I was a little bit older than you. I was 21 when my cataplexy started. So, and it felt just dramatic. It sounds to me like you kind of just ended up incorporating it and thinking it was a little bit more normal.
Yeah. For me, I really in high school just kind of went with it because I was like, well, I don't know what's happening, but it's not interrupting me enough that I need to find an answer. And so I think that's why it took so long for me to finally like go about taking a second opinion and seeing like why my pediatrician said one thing and then why I'm still having all these things happen to me. Like if it's not normal, then there should be something that could be done about it.
I feel like it's super common, especially for young women, for people to say, oh, she fainted, right? Like, I think people think, oh, it's a vasovagal episode, right? Like this, especially if it's a fall. I feel like that's something people have told me a lot, that when this gets misattributed, it's thought that it's like, oh, well, you stood up too fast. You know, you stood up too fast and passed out, right? They don't attribute it to narcolepsy. And I think that the slurred speech and the jaw slackening, and that is super common. And also people don't always recognize that that's cataplexy. So I've diagnosed people who, you know, meet criteria for narcolepsy, tell me they don't have cataplexy. I've never seen them experience cataplexy. And then later on, they realize like after the diagnosis, oh, that's what that was. And it has been most commonly, they realize it's a speech related thing.
Someone in the Rising Voices group that I was in talked about the slurred speech, almost feeling like you're trying to talk with Jell-O in your mouth. And that I completely agree with.
Yeah, I think one of our other advocates also has described that it's almost like she would lose her smile when she laughed. People always said, why do you lose your smile when she was happy and stuff, and just not being able to even hold your muscles up to smile. So there's so many things here. I think we should just touch quickly on how it may look different in children. There can be some more like tongue protrusions and some different ways that it comes out in kids. I don't know if we have to talk about it too much more, if Dr. Sharkey wants anything to add to like the pediatric presentations and how it can look a little different.
I mean, I think, again, one of the things that I think happens, and Katie brought this up, is people are like, well, are they doing this on purpose? Or do you, right? Like, what does it look like? Does it look like anything? People, I think, in that pediatric age group worry about seizures, right? So there's a little bit of jumping to a conclusion before sort of really asking enough questions to suss out what's happening, right? So like, you know, they say, when you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, right? And so, you know, I think that's why people might say in a teenage girl, oh, she passed out, she needs to drink more water, or oh, that little kid is having a seizure, rather than really putting it all together.
All right. Common triggers for cataplexy. This is so important too. And thank you, Lauren, for helping to put together this list from one of the leading papers by Dr. Overeem, I believe, has described. They described, I think, like 30 or so different triggers, and they looked at the most common by surveying people with narcolepsy. So here are some that we thought to share here. Laughing excitedly, making a sharp-minded remark, telling a joke, unexpectedly seeing a friend, feeling angry, being startled, or experiencing an orgasm. And we definitely wanted to include that there. I don't think it's always actually included in every list you see, but I know that was a big part of my experience initially, when I was initially writing my book, I'll just share this. I did not include that I was experiencing like my head falling back, that same weird sensation in my head of cataplexy with sexual excitement. And then as I wrote my book, I just felt that when I did tell people, they were like, oh my God, not your sex life. And I was thinking, you know, actually it's harder for me to like be afraid of walking across a room holding a cup of coffee or, you know, being on an escalator. There's a lot more, or swimming. Like there was a lot of places that experiencing cataplexy scared me a lot more than being in bed with my boyfriend. However, it seemed to, it's an interesting reality. And so after I spent a few years alone with the text of my book before I published it, I ended up getting extra honest and including that in my book. And I'm glad I did, because I think that is a part of it as well. But there are a whole list here.
That's so important. I just want, again, I'll pop in and say, I think that's super important though, because sometimes people have some symptoms or they've experienced cataplexy in one situation, but not another. And I always try to educate people about this, because it's better to find out by someone telling you, I think, than having to experience it for the first time. And, you know, when you're intimate with someone, that might be something you'd want them to know ahead of time, perhaps, right? Like, I think I get where the sort of wanting to be discreet or keep your privacy, but at the same time, you're a warrior and you're such a great role model for people. But I think really being honest, that's critical. If we don't tell people, how you want them to find out? I'd rather tell people.
Yeah.
And there's the element of surprise, I think, in here. And like, people have told me it's if they're laughing, but only if it's like really funny. You know what I mean? Right. Like, it's not like a haha, but it has to strike them as funny. But I'll let Katie pop in.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the common triggers on here that I didn't anticipate was the anger. And I was a hall director in grad school, and I would have to confront situations with students that were not doing appropriate things. And I distinctly remember one night our dorm had a basement, but you could see into the basement and I could hear loud music coming from it. And I was coming back from just being out and about, and I'm like, okay, I don't want to have to deal with this, but I know I need to. So I went up to the window to confront the party, and I had an RA inside confronting the door. But when I was addressing the students, I was very loud with them, telling them to turn off their music and like get their IDs out, things like that. But I was shaking while I did it. And so one of the students like stopped me and he's like, are you okay? I was like, yes, I have a condition called cataplexy, and you are making it like rise up right now. Could you please just follow my direction and do what I'm asking you to do? But it was one of those times that I was like, oh, okay, like this is very much like triggering my cataplexy, but I also need to be able to pull it together so that I can like keep doing what I need to do for work.
Yeah, I think so much of it, in my opinion, is around communication. And your example points to that. That communication, especially about layers of communication, irony, or, you know, I know for me, like talking about anger or annoyance, I often think of it as more like when I'm annoyed, that like in the library of law school, some people were being really loud and you're not supposed to be. So I could walk over and ask them to be quiet. If I thought they should know better internally, and I was going to go over and be like, hey, can you please be quiet? Nicely, but underneath I'm thinking judging them sort of, I couldn't do it without having cataplexy. I had to reframe my thinking to think they genuinely don't know they're doing anything wrong. And I just have to communicate with them. And if I went in with that very genuine intention of just communicating without the judgment or the annoyance below it, I was able to do it without cataplexy. So it's a strange workaround, but I think it's a lot around communication of layer, irony, telling a joke, thinking I'm funny, knowing I'm about to be funny. Oh no. As I know the worst for me a lot more than like people think, oh, if you watch a movie or something funny, it's more interpersonal connections, inside jokes with close friends, stuff like that.
Yeah. That's so interesting, right? Like because I think there are times where it's a great skill set to be able to depersonalize, right? Like it's personal when you're like, well, I have this test that I have to study for and you guys are being loud in the library and it is very emotional. And it's probably healthier, right? Like psychologically to not have to feel that angry, you know what I mean? Like for it to take up so much of your emotional energy when they're just being not considerate in the library. On the other hand, I think that's great, right? We could all probably take a page out of that book. You know what I mean? To sort of
yes, I do.
On the other hand, not in my personal patient experiences, but I know I've read about people saying that they really a lot of times feel like they have to avoid things, like you know, that it can build barriers too, right? So in one sense, I see this very adaptive, something we could all probably stand to do better when we're just going to speak our mind. But on the other hand, you hate to think people are shutting down or somehow not fully engaging in places where they would ordinarily do so.
Yeah, I know for me, sports is a big one because of the excitement and probably, I think, yeah, something to do with your ego and thinking that you're good at something. So I play a lot of tennis now in the night, which is when my cataplexy tends to creep in towards the evening. And so if I know I'm about to hit a good shot, that can sometimes, I won't drop my racket or completely fall to the ground, but I loosen my grip and then my shot doesn't go in. It's not the end of the world. However, that's just, you know, I think sports might be another big thing that people don't always think of. How about you, Katie?
That in college, I never played sports on a team, but in college we did ultimate frisbee just in a field by our dorm. And I remember running down the field and just constantly tripping as I went down the field. And I knew that that was like odd, but I couldn't manage to get across the field without tripping. And so I was not great at it, but I was just having so much fun and it was exciting and enjoyable. But after I learned I had cataplexy, I was like, well, that's why that's happening. Like that made so much more sense. And then I could think about it in that way when I went to do things like that.
What is happening during cataplexy? This is a good one. So Dr. Sharkey, do you want to help explain to folks what's happening?
Sure. So we know that in people who are living with narcolepsy, one of the key sets of neurons in the brain that isn't sort of functioning the way it's supposed to are these neurons in the lateral hypothalamus that make a chemical called orexin. And one of the really nice ways I've heard people describe this is this chemical is sort of like a stabilizer for sleep and wake. So we think about people as being all the way awake or all the way asleep. And in people who are living with narcolepsy, because those neurons aren't working as well, some of the features of wakefulness can creep into the night, and some of the features of the night can intrude into wakefulness. So under typical circumstances, people, when they're in REM sleep, are paralyzed. And there is, in fact, another sleep disorder, as I know many of y'all know, called REM behavior disorder, where people, that mechanism to be paralyzed during REM isn't working correctly. And so people can act out their dreams and do elaborate movements and can get hurt during the night because they're actually physically doing their dreams. So muscle paralysis is what's typical during REM. And then in people who are living with narcolepsy, like I mentioned, that the stability of being kind of all the way awake can be disrupted, particularly in conditions where there's insufficient sleep, if somebody is especially tired, or at certain times of day, and or under these circumstances, like we said, where there's an emotion or something that's of high salience. And And basically, because of the inability of those neurons in the hypothalamus, those orexin neurons, to act, REM can, that atonia, the paralysis, can intrude into wakefulness. And like it says, the brain mistakenly paralyzes the body. So it's almost like one part of REM sleep showing up in wake where it's not, where it's really not supposed to be. I hope it makes sense to folks. And I think it also describe, you know, I think it's also important for people to realize that people who are living with narcolepsy often don't have great nighttime sleep either. And so that can, that's, I think, not as well known a fact about narcolepsy that I think is worth mentioning, right? So this, like, you're sleepy because you're sleepy, but also if you're sleepy because your sleep at night is not that terrific.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. In a way that, you know, it was kind of put to me that it's somewhat of a theory, but I think it's a helpful one, is to describe that, you know, during dream sleep, thoughts and emotions are going through anyone, you know, any person's brain, and that perhaps those emotions of those triggers that we just described could be that your brain feels as emotion and thinks, oh, it's dream sleep. Let's go and let's paralyze your body for that dream sleep, only inappropriately while you're conscious. So I know it's somewhat of a theory and it's not fully understood entirely why those particular emotions seem to be triggers for cataplexy, but I always thought that was helpful as well.
I 100% agree. And we know that REM is involved in emotional regulation processes. Again, Julia, it's complex. And, you know, I always tell people, I do like the sort of all the way awake, all the way asleep analogy, because once you start to realize that there's a gajillion different networks in the brain doing lots of different things, some of these phenomenon that seem very unusual start to make a lot of sense, right? So like most of the body or most of the brain's going along doing all the wake stuff, and then that one network isn't doing exactly what it's supposed to, getting triggered with emotion, just like in REM, and, you know, starts doing the wrong thing at the right thing at the wrong time. How about that? The right thing under the wrong circumstances.
I like to describe the symptoms of narcolepsy a little bit as like a pressure towards REM. And sometimes I wonder what Katie thinks about this. Like, I feel like, especially when I'm really tired in the middle of the day or something. And let's say now I work from home, which is much more convenient. But when I worked in an office building and I was taking naps in my car, I would feel really sleepy and I would start walking towards my car and I would think, please don't let me see a friend. Please don't let me see a friend, because I felt my brain wanted to go into REM either way, through cataplexy, if I saw someone and it caused an emotion, which caused the trigger of the paralysis, or I was going to get to my car and then I would take a nap, which I think was always very dream REM filled. So I like that kind of, it's like that pressure toward, I don't like experiencing, but I like that thought of, it's kind of this, my brain just wants to go towards REM more than it should. Katie, is that your experience, that sometimes like your sleepiness and your cataplexy are?
Yeah, definitely. The more tired I was, the more cataplexy I was experiencing, and in multiple ways. Like, usually if it was early in the daytime, it would only be the slackening of the muscles in my knees. But if it got towards the evening, it, like, the slurred speech came out. I would feel muscle weakness in my arms. So I would definitely experience it more the more tired I was.
One thing I forgot to mention, and when we were talking about triggers, sorry to go back, but something that just a pet peeve of mine is often people describe these as strong emotions. And I just want to point out that I really believe that a lot of these things are often very subtle. And so one of the initial experiences I had was waiting at a crosswalk for the walk signal, and had the walk signal. And then I start crossing the street and then a car almost took the right-hand turn into the lane. Hey, would I call this a strong emotion? Not at all. Everyone knows that feeling where you just kind of give the car a stare, like, don't you dare come in my lane. It is not a big deal. It was nothing I'm writing home about or like telling anyone about. It doesn't matter at all. But that's a very subtle, in my opinion, emotion. And that triggered my knees to buckle. So I just kind of want to dispel that a little bit, because my opinion, when we talk about strong emotions, or sometimes people only say like positive emotions are a part of it, but it's not just positive. So that's just one thing I forgot to mention back here.
Katie, do you have that? Do you want to stay on this at all, Julie? Because I definitely think that that's, and sort of what's a strong emotion to one might not, you know, in some ways, how you feel is how you feel, right? And clearly it's going through this pathway that, like you said, is kind of pressuring towards the REM, all of the REM phenomenon. Yeah, so I understand the sort of objection.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be like that. The biggest surprise or the biggest annoyance, yeah. Or, you know, it's not like we're out there like super like, nah, you were trying to come in my lane. It's just like, don't you dare. And then I felt it. So, yeah.
One of the people I have the pleasure to care for realized she had it when she realized there were people she couldn't talk to on the phone without, like, it was confrontation. It was like exactly like you just described, Julie, but she's somebody who would have said, I don't have it. And then finally was like, I think I do have it. So,
and then do you ever want to tell those people you're a cataplexy trigger? I mean, right? Yeah. A good way, like with my best friend, it's like, it's a good way. And then other people, it's not a good way.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
How do you evaluate it? How do you treat it? I'm interested to hear Dr. Sharkey's perspective. I don't think I've ever really had cataplexy in front of my doctor too much, because it is much more like with my friends and family and all that. But I think that's probably, you know, you mostly can just like, you ask people and hopefully you can like suss it out, you know, like find the cataplexy in what people describe as a patient's learning from the doctor and, you know, looking for resources and better understanding it. So, you know, if you hadn't already had a sleep study because of, you know, let's say we kind of wrote possible sleep study because you're thinking, well, maybe you already had a diagnosis of narcolepsy, but you didn't think you had cataplexy. You might not need to have a second sleep study just to determine you have it. But if you haven't been diagnosed at all yet, yes, you would have to likely go through a 24-hour sleep study to get evaluated to see if you have type 1 narcolepsy and whether or not your brain was going into that REM sleep during the MSLT, the daytime nap test. So just a reminder, there's no cure, but treatments are available, which have been very helpful. I know for me, I'm sure Katie can speak to it. Some of the treatments that are FDA approved for cataplexy include different oxybate therapies that you take at night, also a histamine-directed therapy. And some of the initial treatments before those ones are more recent and approved, yay. A lot of people also antidepressants, because I believe they suppress REM sleep. So all three of those, you know, types of therapies are all really important to help different people manage cataplexy. So yeah, I lucked out. I was diagnosed and quickly started treatment to help manage my cataplexy. Katie, what was your experience with that?
Well, I was definitely surprised to hear that there was no cure when I was diagnosed. That really was hard to deal with. And even now, almost 15 years later, is like, gosh, the treatments are there, but not having a cure is really difficult to deal with, because I would like to see a time where I don't have to deal with taking medicine at night and dealing with all the things that come with that. When I was originally diagnosed, I was offered the nighttime medicine option, but was not able to do it because of the job that I had at the time. I needed to be on call in the evenings. And then I did try another steroid type option, but it just didn't work for me. And so I went another 4 years without medication. And then it was when I finally was working full time that, and then also having to commute to my full-time job, that I was like, I have to find something that will work. And that's when I started the nighttime medicine. And it really has decreased my cataplexy a lot, unless there's a reason that I only take one dose in an evening, that I don't typically see cataplexy day to day, which has been really great.
Dr. Sharkey, what's your experience as far as evaluating and treating it?
So I will say that if people have a history of cataplexy, that's actually diagnostic. And I think most sleep medicine providers would say, okay, well, if you're having cataplexy, you know, they would probably go through the exercise of doing the diagnostic testing, which is the overnight sleep study followed by the multiple sleep latency testing, or in some cases, we can send cerebrospinal fluid to outside places to get evaluated for the content of the orexin chemical in that brain fluid. But if people give a good history of that, that's, you can sort of say, okay, well, this is what I think you have, and we just need to confirm it, basically. And I've definitely treated and participate in the care of folks who that, you know, they came to me and said, this is what happens. And I said, well, this is what you have. Yeah. And we're just going to do that. Another thing that I think happens very commonly is a lot of people are on an antidepressant that might suppress REM prior to coming to see me, because, you know, as I think folks living with narcolepsy, with either with or without cataplexy, know, there are challenges with having this kind of chronic syndrome and condition that might lead to more anxiety or feelings of depression. And, you know, I think these are very commonly prescribed meds, right? So they're probably in the top five meds that are prescribed in the United States, like across the board. And so one of the things that can be frustrating when you're trying to evaluate someone is they're already on a med that could be partially suppressing cataplexy. And then you have to take them off that med to actually get a reliable test done. There's both a, hey, it can be a really good treatment to use those antidepressant meds, but they're so common that it can actually interfere with testing. And a point that I don't think we've mentioned yet is there can be variability in, like, are you sleepy first or do you have cataplexy first, right? So some people maybe aren't sleepy, but they're having, the sleepiness isn't the biggest symptom. The cataplexy is a bigger symptom. And so people might, if that gets misattributed and it's not the sleepy thing, right, then they're. So I think that these reports of these experiences really need to fall into the ears of people who are going to think about this as a possibility. And that's what I always, when I'm teaching, I'm like, you guys, like, people go 12, 15, 17 years before getting diagnosed. The bar for improvement is low. Like, just like, you just have to think, you at least have to think about not blowing this off and saying, oh, I think you fainted, right? Like, it's hard. So anyway, that's a thought. And then I will say that, like, KDM's mentioned, I feel like most of my people who I care for who have cataplexy, it's pretty well controlled. Like, I think I can think of two people out of dozens, if not 100, which in the smallest state in the country is I take care of many people who have narcolepsy or are living with narcolepsy. I have two that don't drive. So most people, you know, I think that's a thing that comes up is people are worried, oh, am I not going to be able to drive? But we can usually manage it well enough with medications and getting sufficient sleep. That's the other thing I'll say, right? So let me stop. I feel like I'm prattling, but we can come back to that.
Yeah. Oh, well, that brings up a lot. You know, I think driving, for me, the bigger concern, I think people might be more concerned about cataplexy, but for me, it's more about wakefulness, and that driving is one of those activities that's really boring for anyone, rather than experiencing cataplexy when I drive, unless someone's telling me something really funny or I think I'm funny. Possibly, maybe, but yeah.
Startle. There's one person who I think they would be able to drive, except we've not been able to fully get rid of, like, you know, when someone comes in, you're like, what are you doing in my lane? Kind of, but instead of being in the crosswalk,
yeah,
you're in the car.
Yeah. Some reason that doesn't seem to get to me, because I'm certainly driving in LA, but yeah, and it can be managed to some degree. Katie, did you want to add anything?
I would say, like, the startle in the car, I will get startled, but not enough to, like, lose full weakness, but it is, I can definitely see where someone would experience that and be like, oh no, this is not something that I want to deal with right now.
Yeah. And quickly, I want to mention that there are some rare cases where you can have cataplexy with other conditions, very rare conditions like Prader-Willi syndrome, pediatric neurological condition. But for the most part, if you see cataplexy, especially in an adult that, you know, no other medical issues, that's cataplexy because of narcolepsy, as opposed to a few other pediatric rare conditions like Prader-Willi syndrome.
Right. And again, I've been poo-pooing the idea that people think it can't be associated with like passing out, you know, fainting or what have you. But there are definitely folks who I care for who have other autonomic symptoms, like other blood pressure kinds of symptoms. And so you can have cataplexy and you can pass, right? So one doesn't necessarily negate the fact that you couldn't have the other, but I feel like these can be controlled pretty, in my experience, we've been able to help people get a handle on it a lot of times.
Probably a lot more so. I wouldn't say completely better because,
You
know, probably what we talk to about a doctor, it's a lot better, but not certainly gone entirely.
I hope Katie comes back too, because I know she foreshadowed talking about pregnancy and postpartum. And I think that's another situation where a lot of times people choose not to take or cannot take the medicines that they're usually taking, and it can present. It's a special case of having to cope with cataplexy. So
managing it, this is so important. I'm sure lots of people have lots to say on this. And so definitely love to hear from Katie, because you've had this experience with pregnancy, being a mom. I don't know. I would imagine young kids could be pretty annoying at sometimes. I mean, I know they're probably angels, but
I bet they're funny.
Yes, yep. I bet they're really funny and cute too.
Absolutely. For me, managing episodes starts first and foremost with just taking the medicine that I have that can help treat cataplexy. And then really informing other people is a big one for me. So I have never been shy to let people know that I have narcolepsy and cataplexy and what it is, so that they're not alarmed if they see it within me. When I was deciding to start a family, going and talking not only with my sleep doctor, but with my OB about what that would look like, what were the risks, what finishes the benefits of using the medicines that I was prescribed or choosing to stop any of the medicines I was prescribed, was something that we had really good conversations about and helped me make the decisions that I chose to make when I was going through pregnancy, as well as when I was nursing. And so I definitely recommend to anybody to have those conversations with the full support team of any of the doctors that you would be working with through any of those life changes, because they'll be able to help best guide you. And
And also you'll be educating a lot of them.
Right. Yeah. With my OB, definitely. I think when I went into labor and delivery the first time, I told the nurse that I was going to be working with, I was like, my biggest fear is that I'm going to have cataplexy during labor. And how am I going to push this baby out if I have cataplexy? Because I went in at like 9 p.m. the night before my son was born, because my water had broke, but I didn't have him until the next day. So I did not have my nighttime medicine that night. And so I was very concerned about it. And she was great. She was like, if we have to use suction to get the baby out, we will use suction to get the baby out. Everybody will be fine. Like, but she's like, you just let me know what you're experiencing and we will work together on it. And it was fine. I didn't have issues with it. I think I was so focused on the end goal that I was able to just overcome the cataplexy and work through it. And so then when I had my second son, it was so much less fear going into labor and delivery, because I knew what to expect. And I also had been able to take my medicine the night before. So that was nice also.
What about as a parent, how do you manage cataplexy? Do your kids know about it?
Yeah. So my kids do know about it. They haven't seen it too much. They'll see every once in a while, me do like a drop towards the ground, but since it's so well managed, they definitely, compared to like my friends in college would yell timber after I fell, which was something we normalized. It wasn't something that they were doing to be rude or anything, but it's one of those things that I think if they saw it, they might not know exactly what it is. They more know that mom is tired all the time and needs an earlier bedtime than them.
Yeah. I mean, managing cataplexy is like, I love how you describe first taking treatment, informing people. These are just really, really important. And it can be just so day to day. And sometimes you don't feel like educating everyone. Like when I play tennis with a new person and I might have a little bit of cataplexy and because I think I'm good at tennis. And also because the tennis court in particular is not a spot I like to have it, because it's not, you can't get to a wall very easily. Like if you're in the middle of the court, you're kind of on your own out there. And so I don't always feel like, you know, educating everyone is even as, you know, my role as Project Sleep's leader, I don't always want to be in education mode. But as Katie said, I think it is really important to tell people. So I generally do. I'm not sure they quite understand, but I was playing tennis the other day with someone and I said, I might have some cataplexy, this kind of muscle thing. And he said, like, what should I do? And I said, well, at most, I'll probably just stop like playing and just stand still, because that's how I kind of like freeze myself. And I just stop playing the point and just stand there and kind of teeter. And I said, just don't engage me. Don't be like, are you okay over there? Because I was afraid that emotion might kind of keep triggering it. It's just to be calm and let me just stand there and not to engage me, which is, you know, maybe counterintuitive, because maybe he'd like think to come to my rescue or try to communicate with me when the communicating would only make it worse in the moment. So, you know, I think that kind of way I just kind of stop physically. Some friends have noticed, like, we'll be walking down the street and talking, and then they keep walking and then they look back and they realize I'm not with them and they'll come back to me. And then in that instance, they know, because they're close by, to stand next to me, and I kind of can lean right on them and let a little bit of my head and my shoulder like lean and let some of that muscle weakness come out with their support. Anything else about managing as a mom? Katie, I feel like there's, you know, anything else you want to share about cataplexy and how you manage it day to day?
I would just say really being open with the people that are around you and having conversations, not being afraid to go back to your sleep doctor and ask for more help or share what your experiences are. For a while, I had been seeing the same practitioner and didn't feel like I got much further in treating everything that I was still dealing with. I still felt like I was more sleepy during the day than I expected to be, things like that. And have recently made a change and practitioner, and that has helped reopen the conversation to looking at what other things might I look at or what might I adjust. And so that has been really helpful, just to remember that because there is no cure, that doesn't mean there's not new things that are coming out in the market or that there aren't other things that other patients have tried that might work for me. So being open to what those might be and trying different things out.
And Julie, if I can just, so I have the honor of being the honorary auntie of many babies of moms who are living with narcolepsy. And I think, you know, the data show first that the vast majority of birthing parents do not have cataplexy during delivery. And so even though, Katie, I would have been right there with you, like, oh my gosh, is this going to happen to me? It's interesting. Maybe it's that mom superhuman strength thing or whatever, but like typically, like it's not common that that happens in research studies that have looked at it. So that's one thing. The other thing is the very first time I managed somebody who was living with narcolepsy and going to deliver, we convened this conference with the OB-GYN, and we wanted to make sure, and an inter, like a medicine doctor within the OB hospital and everything. And the OBs were like, we'll get the baby out, right? So like, here's me worrying. And they were like, pish posh, Sharky, right? They were like, we're surgeons, don't worry. We'll get, you know, I mean, and I don't think I've had anybody who has delivered who's needed to have certain, you know, like that it required a section because of that or anything. So I just, you know, I would say that growing your family is something that is obviously a really personal decision and all that, but I would hate to think that just because there's no cure for this, that it deters people from experiencing what I think, you know, many people consider a big part of their life is to grow a family if they find, you know, the right, whatever, right? But yeah. You wouldn't want to not do it, because this isn't the reason not to do it if that's something that you want to do. So
a quick shout out to our narcolepsy and pregnancy toolkit and discussion. For more on that, check out our toolkit.
one more tidbit that Dr. Sharkey reminded me of. One of the things that is most challenging as a parent with narcolepsy and cataplexy is the nighttime medicine when my partner has to leave town. So that is something that I have found, like, I'm lucky enough that my parents, they will fly in and stay with me if that's something that I need, or if it's like one night or two night and we're here and there's local family that can be available, that works too. But that is one of the things when I think about like the future of medicines in narcolepsy, I'm hopeful that there will be options that can control cataplexy just as well as the nighttime medicine without it being the nighttime medicine. So that's something that's not a hurdle that I have to overcome. And I imagine other people are likely having to deal with that too, because the thought of being on the nighttime medicine and my kids getting up and needing me and not being available to them in the same way I would be if I wasn't on that is difficult.
For sure. Thank you so much for pointing out again the importance of like the real experience. So just a reminder, Project Sleep is just one of a group of amazing nonprofits in this space. So please check out these other nonprofits for more information about narcolepsy, idiopathic hypersomnia, cataplexy, all the things. We do have a list of international organizations as well on our World Narcolepsy Day page. Other resources, there is the Narcolepsy 360 podcast by Wake Up Narcolepsy, and checking out that hashtag narcolepsy on different social media platforms is amazing to find your community. Community is so important. Sharing experiences, knowing you're not alone is just so important. So get connected with us on social media. And that's it for now. So thank you guys. Bye for now.
The Project Sleep podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.